Tonight's lecture is entitled Eating Disorders in the Jewish Community, Detection, Prevention, and Treatment. Once again, I think you know how I will begin. I will begin with a disclaimer that I am not a physician. I am not professionally trained in the detection, the prevention, or the treatment of eating disorders. However, I've put time and thought into this presentation, and there are enough physicians in the room that have been authorized to throw in the flag at any point if I step out of line or if anything is misstated. That which we're going to share tonight, for the most part, is pretty straightforward, though, so I don't really think that there's too much that could be misstated. Of course, there's not going to be any real clinical counsel that's going to be given this evening. So really, this is for the purpose of generating awareness, so people who know very little or nothing about eating disorders can become a little more educated. And those of us who are familiar perhaps can, hone in and fine-tune our understanding. So let's begin with the question, what is disordered eating? After all, if we're going to speak about eating disorders, we can't speak about it in an abstract sense. What does it mean when we speak about disordered eating? So I thought that it would be more productive if we turn the question around a little bit and talked about what is normal eating. Because in order to understand what is abnormal, in order to discuss what is disordered, so let's talk about what's considered normal eating. So a couple of points for consideration. Number one, eating satisfies a physiological need, right? We're hungry, and we eat. Not to say that there's no one in this room who ever tastes, enjoys a snack if we're not really hungry or if our bodies are not actually starving for food. But for the most part, eating satisfies a physiological need. Normal eating is when appetite is regulated without conscious input. So if I'm feeling hungry, it's not that I check my calendar and it says, oh, it's 3 o'clock, so it's about now that I should start to feel the pangs of hunger. Rather, there's an internal mechanism that hopefully is working properly, which prompts me subconsciously to feel either hungry or satisfied. Eating is controlled by hunger, appetite, and satisfaction. So for the most part, the process of eating is controlled by these experiences. I feel hungry, I have an appetite, and then I feel satisfied. Personal taste plays a moderate role in food selection, and eating is pleasurable. Of course, God could have created the world with nothing but bread and water, and we would still be here to talk about it. But the fact that there's a world which has such a variety of tastes and flavors and textures, so that's something that makes the eating experience more pleasurable, more enjoyable, and that is all part of the normal eating experience. Sensible choices help regulate portion control and nutritional intake, meaning when we act sensibly, so we don't eat more than we should, and we don't eat less than we should. Nutritional intake is something that typically happens, again, subconsciously. Sometimes people benefit from being educated into different food groups, but for the most part, we are wired to be able to see to it that we get the nutritional values and foods that we need. And if and when there's a deficiency, it usually could be addressed rather simply. Finally, normal eating accommodates temporary shifts in schedule, needs, or environment. So, for example, it allows for an occasional fast or feast with no disruption or sudden instability. So a person who is accustomed to normal eating could fast for 25 hours in Yom Kippur and recover from it pretty simply without finding themselves in complete disarray in the days and weeks that follow. And everybody can enjoy a good festive meal, maybe two or three. Going back to previous lectures, that's not always a good thing. But we can do that without throwing our entire system out of whack. Here you have a very, very simple, straightforward chart, or a cycle rather, which is just an illustration which captures the hunger cycle. Hunger, which leads to eating and fullness, and the emotional experiences that go along with that, anticipation, the pleasure, and the satisfaction. So if this is normal eating, so now we could talk, before we get to the next thing, this is actually an illustration as well, which points out that the process of eating and hunger and satisfaction that we mentioned is not merely a psychological one, but there are very real biological systems at play over here, and there are actual hormones that are secreted by the body before we eat and after we eat, which either initiate the appetite or suppress appetite depending on the needs. And several of those hormones which are, well known to many of us are listed over here. Ghrelin, insulin, PYY, leptin. These are all secreted by the body in order to make sure that we are taking in what we need and for the most part, like I said, no more and no less. So now that we know what normal eating is, let's talk about disordered eating. Disordered eating includes eating or restricting, which means either complete or partial restriction of food, to satisfy a psychological or emotional need. This is very different than what we discussed earlier, where I may enjoy eating, I may have my favorite foods, but that's not really the driving force behind my eating. I'm eating because that's something I need to do, and I'm going to enjoy it in the process. But eating or restricting in order to satisfy a psychological or emotional need is an example of disordered eating. Appetite is regulated with conscious input. So a person is now thinking about whether or not they are hungry, whether they want to be hungry, or whether they're not hungry. And that input is not necessary and actually not appreciated by the system because it can actually complicate things. Eating is controlled by will, by planned diet, as opposed to, like I said, just sort of allowing the body to take the lead. Eating is not necessarily pleasurable. This is actually a very interesting discussion, and there's no clear conclusion in the research as to whether or not people who are eating disordered enjoy eating or they don't. They will certainly, for the most part, describe eating as being a painful experience, certainly anorexics, but that's not necessarily clear if it is actually pleasurable or not, but it is not necessarily pleasurable. Portion control and nutritional intake becomes severely compromised. This is not something that needs to be studied, but this illustration over here sort of shows you what's going on inside of a person who's eating disordered as opposed to there just being some sort of natural, subconscious flow of the body working properly, and now all these emotions are in the mix and interfering in a person's ability to make choices. Most fascinating, perhaps of all, what's really incredibly frightening about an eating disorder is that the brain is essentially turning on itself. One of the most amazing features of the human body is that we are wired without even realizing it, for survival. And we are familiar with certain, well-known bodily systems that change, that adapt, that adjust as needed in order to make sure that we stay alive at all costs. Eating disorders in general, and anorexia in particular, is, which we're going to define in more detail a little later, reveals a disorder in which the brain is actually working against its own survival. The natural instinct for survival becomes compromised. And so in this rather disturbing illustration over here, and I wouldn't say that this is true in all cases of dieting, because I'm certainly not that extreme in my views, but dieting forces the brain to eat itself on a literal level it could be understood. But even if it's not at the point where the brain is actually eating itself, it does work against itself. And that's really, more than anything else, I think that captures what's most frightening about an eating disorder, is that if the body were left, if the individual were left to his or her own will without the intervention of others, very likely a person would simply kill themselves even though there are no suicidal tendencies. This is not a person who's making a conscious decision to harm themselves, certainly not kill themselves, but it may very likely happen because of the fact that, again, there's this major, major dysfunction within the brain. Eating disorders are not to be confused with picky eating. I don't know if anybody knows that guy. I think we probably all know him. We've all seen him before. He's called Mikey, right? Wasn't that Mikey? Mikey ate everything, correct. All right. So picky eating, which is a common feature within children and sometimes adults as well, is not an eating disorder. What we're not going to discuss this evening, very interesting, selective eating, an extreme case of selective eating. So I think here as well, the research is inconclusive whether or not that's technically to be classified as an eating disorder or not, but not for our discussion tonight. But kids who are picky, particularly at young age, and even they get older, that's not an eating disorder. Unhealthy dieting, which unfortunately many, many people are guilty of, either chronically or sometimes they go in and out of it, is also not an eating disorder, although, as we're going to discuss this evening, unhealthy lifestyles can be particularly complicated if one is either suffering or lives with those who are suffering with an eating disorder. And overindulgence is as well not healthy. We've discussed in our previous lectures that it's not what God wants us to do with ourselves, and it runs contrary to healthy living, healthy lifestyles. But that is not necessarily an eating disorder. We should be very careful because tonight we're going to say a lot of things about eating disorders, and some of them may sound, if you're not familiar with eating disorders, to be extreme, but we're not looking at every person who has unhealthy eating habits and saying, this person is suffering from an eating disorder. That would be irresponsible. it would do no service to those individuals and probably would do great harm to the population that actually is suffering from an eating disorder. Eating disorders are serious business. Hopefully you realize that because you're here tonight. I'm just going to share with you several statistics that are real and of concern. They should be of concern to us. I believe that all these statistics come from the National Eating Disorder Association. Over 11 million Americans suffer from eating disorders, and this number is up 50% since 1960. We'll talk about the causes later on and see if we can shed some light on that. But that's a significant number, 11%. 11 million. EDs have the highest mortality rate of any mental illness. In fact, I think it could be said that eating disorders are the only mental illness that can actually kill the one who is suffering from it. Extreme depression and other mental disorders can lead to suicide, but that's, you know, that outcome is more incidental. It's not the depression that kills the person, it's what it brings them towards. Eating disorders can kill, and in fact, it's the only mental illness. The mortality rate is rather high, as high as 20% if eating disorders go untreated. Anorexia is the third most chronic illness among adolescents. 95% of those who have eating disorders are between the ages of 12 and 25. 20% of those suffering from anorexia will die prematurely from complications due to their eating disorder. This doesn't mean necessarily that they will die in the throes of the illness, but it does mean that long term, if a person suffers on an ongoing basis from anorexia and there's ongoing insult to the body, which affects development, as well as other bodily functions and could cause permanent organ damage, this is something that could ultimately lead to premature death. And again, according to this statistic, 20% of those who suffer will die prematurely from complications due to this illness. Treatment of eating disorders can cost between $500 and $2,000 a day. Rates of recovery from eating disorders, many of you may be familiar with this. If you've heard about eating disorders, it's pretty famous statistics. One-third recover after an initial episode. One-third continue to fluctuate with recovery and relapse for the rest of their life, but they manage it. And one-third suffer chronic deterioration and don't ever really recover. So obviously these numbers are not exact, but that's an approximate, you know, way of looking at the recovery rates for eating disorders. So they are, we see, very prevalent. They are deadly. And although, you know, treatment and recovery is definitely possible, it's certainly not a given. Now we're going to define the two most common eating disorders. There are many eating disorders, but we are probably most familiar with two. And for the purpose of our discussion tonight, we'll focus on those two disorders. The first one is called anorexia nervosa, also known to many as just anorexia. In anorexia, an individual has a distorted body image and an irrational fear of becoming overweight. So he or she deliberately attempts to lose weight through restriction and other forms of calorie burning and purging. That pretty much sums up anorexia. Several features. Number one, distorted body image. So the person is not in touch with reality and doesn't have a true sense of what their body looks like. And they develop this irrational fear, we've discussed phobias in the past, which usually are irrational, and of becoming overweight. And so they attempt to lose weight through restriction and other forms of calorie burning and purging. That, again, pretty much sums this up. Malnourishment can cause many other physiological complications. So anorexia is the problem, but just take a look at this very disturbing and very, you know, really very humbling list of other physiological complications that can be caused by continued sustained malnourishment. Slowed cognitive abilities, which, if I could just pause for a moment and relate that back to here, just understand and appreciate how complicated it could be when one is trying to care and provide treatment for someone who has a mental illness, and the deeper they get into mental illness, the more their cognitive abilities become impaired. So it's it's a very, very slippery slope. And a malnourished brain can function well in anyone. That's why, you know, sometimes if you miss a meal, you become a little irritable. After a fast, sometimes people can be quite, you know, out of sorts. Certainly, if that goes on over the course of days, even if they're not literally fasting, but on sustained malnourishment can really, really impair a person's ability to think properly. So even if their brain was not disordered, which it is, you'd be dealing with a person that's not really available for therapy, for assistance. How much more so when the person is now literally malnourished? Suppressed immune system, anemia, abnormal blood pressure, suspension of menstruation, which is a very common feature. stunted development, brittle and thin hair, weak muscles, bones, kidney malfunction, and cardiac complications. I don't mean to disturb anyone if you've never heard this before, but it is not uncommon to hear of children, teenagers, but maybe, you know, young teenagers who have been struggling with eating disorders to develop cardiac problems. To have 13, 14, 15-year-olds who were born with perfectly healthy hearts who've had multiple heart attacks by the time they're 18 years old. That is one of the effects of sustained malnourishment, because, again, the body will try to stay alive by eating itself. Cardiac muscle is very rich, and one of the first targets that the body will go after in order to stay fueled. Some symptoms, the most common symptoms that we'll find anorexia, so we're going to divide them into two different categories. First, we're going to speak about food behavior signs and symptoms, and then we'll go back to the body distortion. So dieting, despite being thin. So a person with anorexia will be severe, have a severely restricted diet, eats only certain low-calorie foods, banning bad foods. So this is a sign or a symptom of someone who may have anorexia. Obsession with calories, fat grams, and nutrition. We all look from time to time, maybe always, at the labels, the nutritional labels on the foods that we eat. That in itself is not necessarily a sign of any disorder. However, obsession with that and reading it again and again and again could reveal that there is something which is really disordered about this person's thinking. Pretending to eat or lie about eating, hiding, playing with the throwing away food to avoid eating, making excuses to get out of meals, I had a huge lunch, I'm not feeling well, I have to run. People with anorexia who have been monitored, you know, by other people, have come up with very, very creative ways to hide food in the strangest of places. People who are trained in the treatment of people with eating disorders are usually able to prevent these types of maneuvers. But to a person who is untrained, almost intuitively, people with anorexia can come up with very creative ways of hiding food, and their parents would never know. Most disturbingly, if one has suffering from eating disorder wants to learn about tricks, all they just need to do is go on Google and say tips for hiding food if you have an eating disorder, and you'll have a million hits. So you'll have a whole community of people with eating disorders that will encourage each other and share ideas and tips and ideas that work for them. Preoccupation with food. This may seem to be somewhat paradoxical, very interesting. People with eating disorders are not necessarily revulsed by food. They may not want to eat it, but they're more than happy to prepare food for others. They're more than happy to feed others, and perhaps take a certain pleasure in watching other people eat, because it may give them a certain amount of sense of control. Look, you have all this food. You can't stop yourselves. And look at me. You know, I have all the control in the world. Again, this may all be going on subconsciously, but this may actually feed this disorder. Strange or secretive food rituals, refusing to eat around others in public places, eating in very rigid ritualistic ways, cutting food in certain ways, spitting it out, using a specific plate. These types of rituals, as they're called, also reveal symptoms which are typical for someone with anorexia. So these are the food behavior signs and symptoms. As far as anorexic appearance and body image signs and symptoms, so it's a different set of symptoms. You know, just to keep this interesting, I have pictures over here. There were no pictures for this page because, you know, it speaks for itself, but it's very disturbing, very disturbing. Dramatic weight loss, rapid, drastic weight loss with no medical cause. From time to time, we see people who lose weight. We shouldn't make assumptions that they necessarily have an eating disorder. But it is certainly possible that a person who is otherwise in good health will have dramatic weight loss because of the fact that they are simply not eating enough. Feeling fat despite being underweight, feel overweight in general, just too fat in certain places such as the stomach, the hips, the thighs. Fixation on body image just in general, whether it's weight, body shape, or even clothing size. Frequently weighing in. People with eating disorders will sometimes try to weigh themselves numerous times throughout the day. Before they eat, after they eat, in the middle of the meal, they will do this. Of course, it is not helpful for people with eating disorders to have access to a scale. If you're dealing with a child or a teenager and you have complete control of your home, that may be something you can control. If you're dealing with adults, so they're going to decide whether they have access to a scale or not. Harshly critical of their own appearance, spending a lot of time looking in front of mirrors and just very disappointed with what they see every time, never feels thin enough, and denies the thinness. Most strikingly of all, even though it is very clear that the person is thin, the thinner they get sometimes, the fatter they feel. And there is, once again, there's this never-ending cycle of somebody who's just trying to find, you know, some sort of fix, and not finding it and trying more and trying more and trying more. We don't typically call eating disorder behavior to be an addiction. We speak about addiction when we speak about, you know, drug addiction and alcohol addiction, but in many ways, it is just that. It's not a typical addiction, and strangely enough, it, in some ways, it's antithetical to the concept of an addiction, because over here, it's a person denying the body something and becoming addicted to that experience. Although people with eating disorders have described the feeling of an actual high, that there is an actual high that they get, where somebody who's not eating disordered would feel very tired and feel very weak and feel very cranky. A person who's eating disordered, the longer they go without food, the better they feel. Real, actual euphoria is an experience that has been described. The second and the other eating disorder that we're going to speak about tonight is bulimia nervosa, also known as bulimia. And this is very different. Similarities, but very different. Over here, the individual experiences regular bouts of serious overeating, also called binge eating, which are always followed by a feeling of guilt, which can then lead to extreme reactions such as crash dieting, doing lots of exercise, and purging, which is normally deliberately vomiting. So here, you'll see, if you can remember earlier, we saw an illustration of a normal eating cycle. So the binge-purge cycle looks very different. A person is dieting, they feel hungry, so they eat, and that eating is uncontrolled, leads to binging. Then they feel very bad about it, that leads to purging, and the cycle just continues, again, with the emotional experiences described here as well, control, anxiety, guilt, numbness, redemption, and the cycle continues again and again. It doesn't necessarily have to continue several times a day, although sometimes it does. I think in order to be clinically diagnosed with bulimia, it has to happen several times a week. But usually people who are seriously ill with bulimia will do it more than several times a week. A person who has such an experience once or twice in their life or occasionally goes in and out, experiments, because unfortunately young women and men sometimes, but more often women, do just that because they hear about a friend who tried it and described it. They will actually try it. It won't do it for them, and they'll move right on. That doesn't mean necessarily that person has bulimia. Some symptoms, purging signs and symptoms, using diet pills, laxatives, or other diuretics. People who have bulimia will look for anorexia as well, but bulimia in particular, because they have to, you know, really stay on top of things in order to be able to maintain the weight they want because they're eating, will abuse diet pills, laxatives, and diuretics. It's very disturbing to me, but it is a fact that kids, I do not believe, can walk into CVS and buy Sudafed anymore. Is that correct? They can't, but they can. No one can. Okay, but they can buy laxatives as much as they want. They can. There's only, to my knowledge, one or two diet supplements or pills that are available in a regular drugstore that require somebody to be 18 years old. It doesn't require a prescription, but it requires someone to be of age. I know that some of our local drugstores will sell to kids anyway, because most people don't realize that. It doesn't seem like a pack of cigarettes, so they don't even think about it. But the regular laxatives that are available to anyone. A six-year-old can walk into the store and buy them. Some laxatives are harmless, but most of the laxatives, and particularly ones that would be abused, are very harmful. They can cause permanent damage to the bowel system, and even if somebody is able to recover from the eating disorder, they may never be able to relieve themselves normally for the rest of their lives. Throwing up after eating, frequently disappearing after meals. People who are receiving treatment for eating disorders, when they're in an inpatient facility, are not permitted to use the bathrooms without being monitored. And no one is allowed to go to the bathrooms, even if they're monitored for 1 hour after they eat, because that is a common, again, reaction of someone who is suffering from an eating disorder. And compulsive exercising, following a punishing exercise regimen aimed at burning calories, exercising through injuries, illness, and bad weather, doesn't make a difference. A person will work out and will seem to have superhuman energy, which no one else seems to know where it comes from. But again, they're drawing from resources that most of us wouldn't even know how to use in order to burn more calories. Now, this is a very important point, especially for those of us who may ever be in a position where we notice that someone around us may have symptoms that seem like they're an eating disorder, bulimia, unlike anorexia, is very difficult to identify. And the reason for that should be obvious at this point, and that is that an anorexic will continuously lose weight. Not necessarily at a steady pace, but over the course of time. It will likely not plateau without any intervention, although it may, but it probably won't. A person with bulimia can maintain their weight, or may fluctuate, but not the kind of thing that people would typically detect, for very long periods of time. So the most obvious detector of all is not available with somebody who suffers from bulimia. This is a very disturbing list of some of the symptoms that people will display if they are purging on a regular basis. Most of these are purging. You know, puffy face, scars or red marks on the fingers and knuckles. We have some dentists here. I've heard that, you know, some of the, you know, the first people to detect bulimia may be a dentist who's doing dental work and notices that the back of one's teeth, the enamel is completely worn out. Because of the constant throwing up and the acid from the stomach that is wearing away at the teeth. Again, you look at a person with a beautiful smile, you would never know, and the dentist is the first one to notice that something is wrong. Redness around the eyes, short fingernails. People will keep short fingernails so they don't injure themselves, they don't hurt themselves when they are purging. Frequent visits to the bathroom after eating, food disappearing in large quantities, social withdrawal, fatigue. These are some of the symptoms, but again, obviously, if you see all of these, you know, then you know you have a big problem. But all of these features won't necessarily present themselves at once. And again, someone who suffers from eating disorder will very likely try to hide it, and will, you know, go the extra mile to make sure that people don't detect these types of symptoms. What causes eating disorders? So, as of course you expect by now, because we've discussed several different areas within mental illness, and of course we don't know. We don't know, but by eating disorders, it's pretty clear that they are caused by a complex set of conditions, including behavioral, biological, emotional, psychological, interpersonal, social factors. Genetics play a very, very major role in this. So you have biological, hormonal, chemical imbalance, genetic links, psychological low self-esteem, anxiety, difficulty coping, interpersonal, such as troubled family relationships, difficult expressing emotions, history of physical or sexual abuse, cultural values, peer pressure, focus on beauty, thinness. Just to be clear, a person could have all of these problems and still not have an eating disorder, and a person can have an eating disorder and have very few of these. So certainly when you talk about, let's say, trauma, somebody experiencing trauma in their history, one does not necessarily have to have experienced trauma in order to have an eating disorder, and there are many people who have experienced trauma who don't develop eating disorders. But these are the types of things when they're all together, you can have the perfect storm. Here's, again, just an illustration pointing out that eating disorders are probably born because of a combination of several factors. I will submit to you, in my humble opinion, I'm not sure that's worth anything, but I personally think, and this is not my term, but I've heard this before, that this particular expression, I think, captures what is probably the best theory. I don't know who, you know, coined this phrase. I heard it once from a doctor, and I haven't seen it much. But the concept exists. I just displayed it. The loaded gun theory, which basically means that you have a certain segment of the population that is predisposed to developing an eating disorder for any one of these reasons, genetic perhaps being the most important of all, but then other factors as well. And you would never know. The person would never know that about themselves. You would never know it about them. One's physician would not detect this. One's own parents wouldn't necessarily know. Unless perhaps it's in the family and they would be a little more aware of it. But you have a person who's walking around like a powder keg just ready to explode. And then any one, let's say, of these things on the list could potentially set off a disaster. And what's really important to appreciate about this is that, and I have heard this as well from, you know, experts in the field, and I think, you know, personally makes a lot of sense, that you can have a situation where parents are the worst role models for their children when it comes to eating. You know, total, you know, dysfunction when it comes to eating, all, you know, the bad messages, and they tell their kids, you know, you're too fat, you're eating too much, you know, you're too skinny, you're not eating enough, don't eat that, eat this. What? Just imagine the worst parenting. You could have somebody else who is just exposed to some very seemingly, you know, benign comments and situations, which could trigger an explosion inside. And so, it means different things for all of us, you know, but it's a very important message to keep in mind, and that is that there is a segment of the population that is predisposed to this because of nothing that they've done. People don't choose to get eating disorders just like they don't choose any other illnesses we've discussed in the past. And, you know, we have to be sensitive, therefore, as to what messages we send because we don't know how those messages will affect different people. When in doubt, obviously one should refer for help. Maybe that's not obvious, so I'll take back obviously. When in doubt, you should refer that individual for help. It's beyond the scope of discussion right now for me to tell you to whom you should refer them. This may sound quite presumptuous, so forgive me. But if you're ever in a situation where you don't know who to refer to, you're welcome to come to me because I can then suggest names of who you can go to, because there are many great practitioners in the area on all different levels who will be able to help determine whether or not there's a problem, and if so, how to treat it. I just didn't think it was appropriate right now. You would like to think that you could just tell the person to speak to their pediatrician. Shus Dr. Shus, the Mumcha, my Rebbe in many ways, so I hope he'll forgive me. If you happen to be fortunate enough to have Dr. Shus as a pediatrician, then without a doubt, you can go to him. But I think he'll agree with me that people can be, very reputable pediatricians, but they are not necessarily sufficiently trained to be able to detect eating disorders and will not necessarily give the best advice to parents who have concerns. That's obviously extremely alarming. Certainly it's not an indictment against pediatricians in general. Pediatricians are like in the front line. They have to, possible things come their way. And this is a specialty. And not every pediatrician is necessarily sufficiently trained. And so therefore, you have to be careful when referring yourself or somebody else to make sure that you're going to someone who really has the experience to be able to know what it is that they're looking at. You should never encourage someone to fix it yourself. We've discussed that in the past in other areas. But here as well, there's a tendency that we may have to say, oh, come on, here's what you need to do. On the other hand, don't be an alarmist. But you should know that eating disorders often go undetected until it's too late, and treatment is much more effective with early intervention. Eating disorders work like a vice. When you pull gently, it pulls a little harder. When you pull harder, it's going to be a little harder than that. So you really need a treatment plan that's going to, get a few steps ahead of the eating disorder and get control of it before it's too late. So on the one hand, we don't want to be alarmist and blow the whistle just because we have concerns. But very often, there's not early intervention, that could be a big problem. I'll tell you, very interesting that my own personal experience, there have been several instances where I've had concerns about certain individuals. My wife had concerns about certain individuals, and it's very, very, very unpleasant, uncomfortable to have to go over to somebody who's not coming over to you for advice and offer unsolicited advice regarding their children. But in our experience, number one, the people appreciate it, and in several of those instances, they came back weeks, months, and years later to thank us for our intervention, saying that we, in their estimation, it's probably an exaggeration, but maybe not, saved their daughter's life. Because this is not necessarily something that they would have known. So it's uncomfortable. It's not something that, you should ever want to do. But if you have concerns, again, it's worthwhile to at least begin a conversation with someone to figure out, where to take it from there. Treatment of eating disorders. So as far as health professionals are concerned, we have four different tiers. An MD, a physician, should be obvious in light of all that we've discussed until now in terms of the impact that an eating disorder can have on the entire body and all of the bodily systems, but a medical doctor is going to be necessary as part of the team, depending on the severity of the illness, maybe, on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, monthly basis, bimonthly basis. Patient psychotherapist is going to be, of course, an indispensable member of the team. A family therapist, you may think, why is that necessary? After all, the family didn't do anything wrong, and nobody else in the family has an eating disorder, so let's just take the kid to the therapist. And the reason, which again should be obvious, is that when one person in the family is suffering from eating disorder, it affects everybody else in the family, and very often requires a team effort in order to help this person get the treatment that they need. And finally, a nutritionist, which can provide sound nutritional guidance and advice, even to a person who's healthy, but certainly to a person whose health has been compromised in this regard, what sort of nutrition is necessary to get them once again re-nourished, and also to help people who have fears around certain foods either get over those fears or work around them, at least initially, in the process of their recovery. Depending on the severity of the disorder, someone may need all four, three, two, one of these. Again, that may depend, but you'll need at least one, and likely two, of these professionals on the team. In terms of the level of care, so of course, it depends again. The lowest level of care, outpatient care, is a person who is going to school or going to work, whatever the case may be, and they are checking in with either one or all of the professionals on top on some regular basis and getting the help that they need. PHP, forgive me for the Russia tables, that stands for Partial Hospitalization Program. There are many such programs in which people will spend several hours a day, sometimes, you know, 9 to 5, in a facility in which they receive therapy, group therapy, they're eating meals together, getting coaching through their illness, but they go home at night to sleep and usually over the weekends as well. So it's sort of like either to step down from a more intensive program or to step up if the outpatient program is not good enough. Residential treatment is, of course, the next step where a person cannot really be home at all for a certain period of time. It could be days, it could be weeks, it could be months, God forbid, years. The highest level, inpatient acute level care, would not be years. That would be months or weeks for a person who, unfortunately, has done a lot of damage thus far to their body. And in addition to the fact that they have a serious eating disorder, now they have other medical complications that need to be dealt with. There's actually an acute level care center in Denver, which was established by a Frum doctor, Dr. Philip Mailer. And I think it's one of the only in the country that have devised a way to take people who are literally on the verge of death, who are not even capable of swallowing anymore, Rahman al-Islam, to imagine. We've seen pictures of Holocaust survivors, and forgive the analogy because it may seem inappropriate, but you know there are situations of people who are completely emaciated, who are literally skin and bones and nothing else, barely alive, and they need to be refed, but the problem is they can't even digest food, they can't even swallow, and so, you know, intravenously, there's a way of getting these people slowly but surely, it's a very dangerous process, back to the point where they can be refed so that they can then begin the process of treatment. But that process alone could take many months. Again, those are extreme cases, but there's, you know, unfortunately, an entire center in this country that's been set up for people in that level of illness. In terms of treatment modalities, so there are. If you would go online right now and say and Google like eating disorder treatment, you'd probably come up with you know several dozen different types of treatment which are available. But there really are very, very few that are evidence-based, which means very few that have been tested and which there's research that shows that they actually work. Eating disorders are not new, and they've been, you know, the medical communities have been addressing and treating these disorders for decades. But there's very, very little research that's been done for whatever reason. Research has begun recently and for the most part shows that there are just several treatment modalities that seem to be effective. As far as individual and group therapies, cognitive behavioral therapy, which we discussed briefly in a previous lecture, and dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT, they are related. Both of them are designed to address behaviors in addition to, but for the most part, behaviors as a means of getting a person's, you know, mind once again working in order. You know, very often when we think about the approach of psychotherapy, we think about psychoanalysis, about trying to figure out why you're doing this, why you're behaving in this way, how can we get you to look at it differently, and then hopefully your behaviors will change. Well, the you know current feeling in the world of psychotherapy is that actually dealing with behaviors as a means of bringing people forward and initiating progress is much more effective. Dialectical behavioral therapy is a little, perhaps a little more back in the other direction, as patients are trained to understand their emotions. They develop techniques, you know, to understand, you know, mindfulness and to understand and appreciate their emotions and why they're feeling, how they're feeling, as a means of, you know, helping them develop better behaviors. Family therapy, couples therapy, so very often eating disorders require a team effort, and the team effort expands beyond the medical team you mentioned earlier, requires family. The most effective evidence-based treatment that seems to be available right now, and that really is for the most part the only serious one that's being pursued by treatment centers throughout this entire country, are based more or less on what's called family-based therapy or the Maudsley approach, because it was either discovered or popularized in a hospital in London, Maudsley Hospital, psychiatric hospital. And this approach is one which also sort of focuses on behaviors more than thoughts, but involves members of the family to refeed this person and to help usually one's child eat, even if he or she doesn't like it. The advantage to the family-based therapy is that it happens at the home. A child doesn't have to be out of the home, and parents get to be involved in helping their children recover, which is, of course, the greatest chos in the world. Of course, it's a lot cheaper than $2,000 a day in a hospital. The disadvantage is that it could be a full-time job. And it could be a full-time job for somebody who already has a full-time job and has other members of the family that rely on them to go to work. And so, therefore, it's not so simple. In addition, not everybody is necessarily cut out for it. And it almost always requires, you know, training, therapy for the members of the family that are involved in this. So it's certainly not, you know, a walk in the park, but it does seem to be the most effective, the most holistic, the one that is most therapeutic, the one that seems to be most effective, and let's be honest, the one that really makes most sense in terms of helping a person recover. It's important to note, and I can't believe it's already 9:15, I've mentioned this yet, that those struggling with eating disorders often require treatment and maintenance of comorbid psychiatric conditions and disorders. Often, I don't know the statistics, but often, if not the majority, the overwhelming majority of the time, people with eating disorders also have other psychiatric disorders, some of which we've discussed already, you know, anxiety disorders, mood disorders, personality disorders and the like, and so therefore it becomes very complicated in terms of, you know, separating all the different parts. Somebody who's in the throes of an eating disorder is not available to really treat for these other areas. Medication could still be used at times, but for therapy they're not necessarily able to until their brain is renourished and they're able to function on a level in which, you know, those other areas can then be separated, tweaked, and then treated separately. The title was Eating Disorders in the Jewish Community, so we haven't spoken about the Jewish community yet. I'm going to really try not to go over tonight. It's 9:15 already. There was a New York Times article in April 2001 titled Rabbis Sound an Alarm Over Eating Disorders. One study cited in this article says that in Israel they find that disordered eating among Jewish adolescents is much higher than Arab ones. And Israel's rate of dieting is among the highest in the world. Another statistic about American Jews, one in 1996, an Orthodox high school in Brooklyn found one in 19 girls had an eating disorder. That's 50% higher than the general population. This was done, of course, the agreement that the name of the school would not be published. I know the school. If you want to ask me, I'll tell you privately. Not just showing up. The other study, which was done in 2008, looked at 868 Jewish and non-Jewish high school students in Toronto and found that 25% of Jewish girls suffered from eating disorders, compared with 18% of non-Jewish girls. So what does this mean? Nothing. Because if you ask experts, they'll tell you it's inconclusive. The article, obviously, it was a front-page article, got a lot of attention, and it served a purpose because it got people talking. However, these studies were probably not carried out in a real scientific way, and as much as I'd like to tell you that it's a bigger problem in the Jewish community, the reality is that there does not seem to be any real evidence or data that has been published, that is produced to indicate that it is. One thing is clear, and that is it's as significant here as it is out there. So to say that it's not an issue here is denial at best, but it is to suggest that there is evidence that there are higher rates of prevalence within the Jewish community is inconclusive. There are actually several studies, I'm not going to read them to you right now because we're definitely out of time, which would indicate that religious orientation, spiritual well-being seem to actually give a patient or someone suffering from eating disorder an edge in overcoming the eating disorder. So this would actually suggest that if you're a member of a, not necessarily a Jewish community, but just a religious community, you may actually have a better chance of recovery and maybe at less risk, as this quote from the abstract seems to indicate. High levels of spiritual well-being were moderately associated with lower levels of body dissatisfaction, which are no association with disordered eating. Overall, these findings suggest that having an intrinsic religious orientation may confer protection from eating and body image disturbance. So if anything, the studies that have been done on this, that have been published, seem to indicate that you're better off if you're part of a religious community. Here's another one as well. On the other hand, these are areas for honest consideration. We have in our community high demands and expectations of ourselves and children, and this can be very triggering to those who are vulnerable. Again, going back to the loaded gun theory, if people are already predisposed, our lifestyles, the way we live them, are the types of things that can trigger many people with certain predispositions. Eating disorders is one of them. Highly competitive community, peer pressure, the shidduch process, I'm calling it. This is not the shidduch crisis, but this is the whole process is complicated, to say the least. Larger family sizes, less attention for each child. Centrality of food within our culture and lifestyle. Shabbos and Yom Tov, we're not going back to the five unhealthy habits of Orthodox Jews. We've discussed that already, but food, food, food. I actually learned a word from some of you attend these lectures, foodie. I never even heard the word before after that lecture. So I found out that everybody's heard the word foodie. I never heard about it. So we have a lot of foodies in our community. Let's be honest. I'd like to say for better or for worse, but it's not for better. It's only for worse. And that, again, is going to be at the very least triggering to someone who already has that predisposition. Overindulgence at Kiddush, at various machot, the cookbook craze, which I spoke about already. And of course, we have to be honest, come back to the question of stigmatization. This, again, is not a cause for an eating disorder, but if we're reflecting honestly upon eating disorders within the Jewish community, this is something we need to consider. This is an excellent article written by Dr. Esther Altman, who is a therapist who is well known for her work in eating disorders. She speaks a lot all over the Jewish community. She's spoken in TNAC several times. She has a practice in New York City. So she wrote an article called Food for Thought, Eating Disorders in the Jewish Community. She writes, I found that young Jewish anorectics frequently receive communal endorsement of their emaciated frames. More than one mother has reported the need to ask other women at shul to stop complimenting their anorectic daughters on their weight loss and to stop voicing admiration for their discipline and restraint. This is tragic. But it actually happens in our shul and every shul, and it has to stop. Even within the ultra-Orthodox communities, prescriptions such as no television in the home, designed to protect members from problematic cultural influences, have not provided a successful shield. Another important quote from her article, first, it has been suggested that observant young women develop eating disorders because they have no voice, no other way to say that they are not ready to take on the responsibilities of wife and mother. Many young women or their families worry that they are not skinny enough to start dating for fear that they would be passed over for a girl with a better body. The important question, what size does she wear, is often quoted. Unfortunately, these shidduch stories are not merely apocryphal. Some young men and women harbor the illusion that a perfect body will produce a perfect spouse and a perfect life. Once again, I think it's important to repeat it. We are not suggesting that any of these particular problems cause someone to develop an eating disorder, but someone for whatever reason, is already predisposed. So these types of conditions, these realities, these pressures that are being placed on young women in particular, can push them over the edge. I thought this was not humorous, but made me smile. Reflections in this mirror may be distorted by socially constructed ideas of beauty. So, you know, that's the reality, that when we have distorted, socially constructed ideas of beauty. So very often people look in the mirror and they see something which is distorted. Torah living for the eating disorder. I'm just going to share with you four questions that I've received. Last week we discussed about, we were talking about OCD. Actually, one or two of these questions actually are repeats from last week for those who are not here, especially and for them. This is one of them. Elizabeth, 38, has struggled for many years with an eating disorder. After years of treatment, she has successfully refrained from restricted eating for close to 1 year. Her therapist warned that fasting, even for one day, could potentially trigger a relapse. What should she do on Yom Kippur? You know, speaks for itself. I mentioned this last week, so I'm not going to rehash my entire thought process on that, but the stakes are very high, you know, on both sides. Chaim, 16, I'm just going to stop for one moment and mention that it was deliberate that I used the boy's name. Obviously, the names have been changed. It is true, and again, I forgot the statistic, but it's significant. You know, the female-to-male ratio in eating disorders is quite significant, but young men also develop eating disorders. It's not unheard of, and she should be aware of it, that there are young men that suffer from anorexia and bulimia. Chaim, 16, has been suffering from anorexia for 2 years. He was recently discharged from an inpatient facility where he had been receiving treatment for 7 weeks. Although his weight loss has been completely restored, he has not tolerated any variety in his diet and receives much of his nutrition from supplemental bars which contain chametz. May he continue to eat these on Pesach. If so, should he be encouraged to eat them in a separate room? When he or his father performs a bittul chametz, are these bars to be included? Again, you'll think, that's a silly question. It's a silly question if we're considering this to be a situation where a person is, you know, on the verge of death. But that's not what we're describing over here. We're talking about a person who's completely weight restored, who's back at school, is living a normal life, more or less, but they're still, you know, very disordered in their eating. And once the, you know, religious compulsions get involved in this, it becomes very misubach, very complicated. You know, on the one hand, we don't want chametz at the table. But what is the, how will it impact, if at all, a 16-year-old boy who's coming from anorexia if he's told to eat in another room? So it's a very, very complicated question. I would say it's fascinating, but that would sound dismissive. It's fascinating intellectually, but it's very serious, you know, on an emotional level. Esther, 15, suffers from anorexia and is currently undergoing inpatient treatment. In an effort to optimize treatment, all meals are prepared on site by the trained staff. No outside food may be brought into the facility, which I mentioned last week is the norm. May Esther eat non-kosher food as part of her treatment. If she refuses to eat non-kosher food, may her family lie to her and tell her that the food is kosher. Or, as I mentioned last week, may other members of her family eat the food if it means getting through that next meal, especially if it means continuing the lie and her thinking that the food that she's eating there is kosher, which is necessary because that is the most therapeutically safe environment for her at that time. Bracha, 19, has been recovering from eating disorder and has thankfully made significant progress. She is still unable to eat on her own and relies on her parents to be present with her during each meal. When they cannot be physically present, she has been unable to complete her meals while she has been able to complete her meals while Skyping them. That's right. Real question. A girl, 19 years old already, she's a woman, but she cannot eat without her parents, either there, physically, or Skyping them. An opportunity has arose for her to travel to Israel for 2 weeks, which she would very much like to do, especially given that she was unable to attend seminary with her friends as she was in treatment for eating disorder. Her doctors feel that this opportunity may be a very helpful step towards her recovery. May she travel to Israel, if doing so would require that she and her parents continue to Skype each other during meals, even on Shabbos. I'd like to conclude with a sample letter. This is a letter that was sent by a father of a young woman in our community who had been treated for an eating disorder and then was coming back and sort of making her way back into shul, into school. And the father was concerned that people who wanted to be helpful and encouraging and supportive know exactly what to say and what not to say. So rather than go ahead, as I've done in the past, and say do's and don'ts, so I'm just going to share with you excerpts from this letter. Hopefully we'll finish on time. I'll read it. As you may know, the recovery from an eating disorder typically takes several years and occurs through stages. Thankfully, the most intensive stage of Rachel's recovery treatment will shortly be coming to an end, as she will then begin the next phase of her therapy. Given that you will possibly see Rachel in the coming days or weeks, we wanted to share with you that some of the important do's and don'ts when speaking to someone with an eating disorder. Please do not misinterpret the intent of this message in any way. Needless to say, we are grateful for any positive support that you can offer Rachel. At the same time, however, this entire experience has afforded us the opportunity to gain a broader perspective and a deeper understanding of the eating disorder. As a result, we have learned many things that we did not know beforehand. We would therefore like to be proactive in reducing the amount of negative triggers, albeit inadvertent, that you will undoubtedly encounter. As we have recently come to learn and understand, fundamental eating disorders have nothing to do with food, weight, or calories. A point that, forgive me, I haven't mentioned yet. As such, we have been directed to avoid discussions that include these issues unless the conversation is a controlled therapeutic setting. Please resist any temptation to mention these issues or directly respond to any questions that she may offer on these subjects. So that means if somebody who's recovered from eating disorder says, is this healthy? Does this have a lot of calories? Don't answer. These types of comments should be avoided, even if they are not directed to the person who's recovering. For example, one should not say in her presence, I hate my body, or I just ate so much, or I haven't eaten all day and I'm starving. Additionally, some of the most well-intentioned comments that are directed to someone recovered from eating disorder will often be misperceived or processed quite differently than they were intended. To be more specific, Here are a few general examples of the types of comments that one should not say to someone who is in the process of recovering from an eating disorder. Please note how objections with some of these comments is remarkably counterintuitive. You look great, right? Most of us would say to someone who is just, you know, back from treatment, you look great, without realizing that what you've just done is smacked her on the face really, really hard, maybe set her back a week or two in her recovery. You look so healthy. You know, how could you go wrong with that? Because it's a dirty word. So someone who is still in the throes of an eating disorder, the fact that she's home doesn't mean anything. So to hear you look so healthy is, you know, what she's hearing is, you are weak, you are losing. I see that you're eating a lot better now. Don't you feel better than you used to? Do you want me to get something for you to eat? Are you hungry? I knew someone who had an eating disorder, and she, etc. Please do not ask her any questions about her experiences in the hospital or her immediate future plans, treatments, or school. Additionally, one recovering from an eating disorder will be very conscious of who is looking at her body. It is therefore best not to gaze directly at her other than her face. In fact, it is best to avoid giving any special attention to one recovering from an eating disorder. In fact, it's best not to look at anyone's body. Just thought I'd mention that. It is best to be as natural as possible and avoid coming across as if you are walking on eggshells. It's very difficult, but you have to really, really try and resist that temptation. Remember that a person with an eating disorder will be watching the way you watch them. If she does not open up to you regarding her illness, it is best to listen, not interrupt, validate, not argue, and admit that you can't really understand what she is experiencing. To quote something I've recently read from one with an eating disorder, when looking from the outside in, it is impossible to understand. When looking from the inside out, it is impossible to explain. On a more positive note, here are examples of comments that would be appropriate and can be very reassuring. I've missed you so much. Please let me know if there's anything I can do for you. Let me show you some of the things that are going on in my life, although I cannot promise you that she will want to listen. So I thought this was a very helpful set of guidelines. Again, this is not a perfect script, and you're not going to read off of the paper, but if you have people that you interact with, you know, neighbors, friends, families, friends, whatever the case may be, who are living through this nightmare, just to be aware that sometimes some of the, you know, most well-intentioned, intuitive statements that you would think would be nothing but positive and reassuring and supportive are actually counterintuitive. And it's worthwhile to just review these thoughts in your mind every once in a while. As a general rule, you know, when in doubt, you know, do without. So if you're not sure what to say, probably best not to say anything other than, you know, good Shabbos or nice to see you. You can't really go wrong with that. As always, you know, I end with, you know, a certain degree of satisfaction, but really frustration because I feel that there's so much more that needs to be said on this topic, so much more that should be said on this topic. But again, I appreciate your coming out. I appreciate your listening. Again, not for the purpose of self-promotion, but I just want to remind you that these are available online on the Shul's website and YU Torah. And if you feel that there are people who could benefit from them, I encourage you to point them in this direction. Another thing that I regret, you know, not offering are just a list of resources that are available. And I'm happy to offer that to you privately. Within the Jewish community, there are certain organizations that have been established to be supportive to families with eating disorders. Some of them are actually really, really well-run and can be very helpful. Some of them are criminal and should be shut down, in my opinion. So just don't, you know, Google, you know, get help for Jewish, you know, anorexics and go to the first one that comes up. But there are opportunities for treatment, for recovery, particularly for those within the Jewish community. And there are resources that that the community should be made aware of. Thank you very much. I look forward to seeing you next week for genetic testing and preventive medical intervention in Halacha and Hashkafa. Thank you very much. Have a wonderful night.